This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 122. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
We're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
I am doing great on my new MacBook Air. Good grief, this thing is nice. It's just an amazing piece of hardware. And I had messed around with it in the Apple Store for years, frankly. It was when it first came out, I wanted to go down and see it. And I used it, and you know, it feels so slick in the store. And I kept thinking, yeah, but if I get it home and really start working on it, it's not gonna continue to feel like that. And sure enough, I've pretty much been on it nonstop since yesterday. And now when I go back to any of my other computers that aren't made out of awesome aluminum and, you know, don't just have this gorgeous screen, everything else feels like a plastic toy now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found the exact same experience of going from, actually, I had a Lenovo and then I went to the MacBook Air, and then every once in a while I would go back and take a look at that other stuff. And it's just a world of difference between them.
Yeah, and the thing that convinced me to really give it a shot is that I love my iPhone and my iPad so much, and I use them all the time, and I love the experience on them. I love the UI, I love the UX. I mean, it's just such a cool ecosystem, and I bought into it. You know, I mean, I have tons of apps. I wouldn't switch to Android now purely because I just have so many apps, and I just, you know, have such an investment now in the ecosystem. And so I realized, like, what are the reasons that I'm sticking with Windows? Because I used Macs all through college, so during the 90s, and then it was like 99 when I switched to Windows, and there were a bunch of reasons for doing that. But I've used Windows now, you know, since then, so for about 13 years. But there isn't much actually keeping me using Windows anymore. And when I looked at the Windows 8 UI and realized the learning curve of moving to that, I just realized, why not go through a different learning curve and move over to what I think, especially with the gestures and with all of the stuff they've built into macOS, move over to what I think is actually a better OS.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's a better OS. Do you think it is? Do you use it enough to know?
I don't know. I alternate back and forth between them. I think that the kernel itself seems like it handles certain things better than on the Windows side. So like for multitasking, it seems like the OS X kernel handles some of that stuff a lot better. But the vast majority of the stuff that I do is still in Windows. So I still have a lot of stuff running there. I don't know. I mean, I like the gestures as well. But personally, I kind of like switching back and forth between the operating systems, because there's certain things I do in Windows and I find that I'm much more productive there than I am on the OS X side. And then same thing with OS X. There's certain things I do over there, which I feel like I do a lot better over there.
Yeah, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to switch 90 to 95% over to OS X. And so there will definitely be a learning curve. There already has been. But although I have to have Windows up to do some .NET development, I'm doing so little of that anymore that I'm pretty much going wholesale over to the Mac side. And I got to be honest, the gestures have been pretty amazing. I've been really impressed with it. I have a question for you. Is it cheating to map the command functionality to your control key? Because that's what I've done. Because, you know, my keyboard shortcut hand has been doing this for 13 years, hitting control everything instead of this command key.
Mm-hmm.
So I remapped it, but I'm wondering, like, am I really making a wholesale change if I do that?
Like I said, I switch back and forth between the two almost all the time because I run them side by side through VMware Fusion. And one of the things that I kind of realized, I used to be a very big proponent of just leave everything with the default settings. That way you don't have to worry about if a vendor screws up an upgrade or if you move from one machine to another. But the fact of the matter is that, like, over the years, I've come to the realization that, you know, I don't generally use other people's computers, and I like my machine to conform to me versus me conforming to the machine. So I just remapped a bunch of things to make things easier for me. So I did remap some of the keys. I don't think I remapped the command key.
What's going on with you this week?
So I've been doing a lot of work with AdRoll lately. Their interface looks really top-notch, but one of the things that really bugs me about using AdRoll is the fact that when you're doing things, it takes forever for some things to show up.
So what is, there's a delay between when your ads run?
I assume that there would be for that. But like when you first start out with AdRoll, there's a few things that irked me. Like when I first signed up, it has absolutely nothing about like what their media requirements are. So what image sizes or anything like that. You basically have to create an account and then you get in and then you go through the process of creating a campaign. And they're like, oh, you need images that are these sizes. It's like, thanks. That would have been nice to know before my 2-week trial started so that I could go to my designer and have that stuff ready. So It took me about a week to kind of get through that process. And then once I got through that process, then they said, oh, well, you've got to install this Smart Pixel. So I go to install the Smart Pixel and it doesn't work. And I try all these different things, still doesn't work. I get on the phone with support and they're like, oh, well, your JavaScript is indented. It's not copied exactly the way we sent it to you. One, that seems ridiculous. I mean, as a programmer, that just seems absolutely ludicrous that my JavaScript is indented differently than you indent it. And that's why it's not working. But aside from that, I asked them how long it would take for things to show up. And they're like, oh yeah, it would take about a day for us to see that you've got this pixel installed. I'm just like, it's just frustrating as all heck.
Right, because you want to get rolling on it quick.
Well, yeah, because I've got deadlines that I'm trying to meet. I've got certain timelines that I'm trying to do things in. And it takes forever to get some of this stuff done. And then they say that for them to recognize like different visitors, they batch it up. And it could be 16 hours or so before they recognize that any given visitor has come in. And they force you to have a minimum number of visitors before they'll start running any of your campaigns.
Right.
So,
yeah. So it does take a while. You know, you should ask them to extend your trial.
Yeah.
I mean, you need more than 14 days because it sounds like you're already 8 days into it and you don't even have ads running. So
right.
I would probably ask for 14 days from the start of the ads. I think when I did, I don't use AdRoll anymore, but when I did, that's what we did. Because I went through a similar thing where it was like a week before I was up and then they started my trial then.
Got it.
Hey, I wanted to bring up another Micropreneur Academy member who has had a lot of success. His name's Patrick Thompson. He's a lifetime member. He's attended both of the microconfs last couple years, and he's coming to this one as well. But he has a whole suite, a portfolio of mobile apps. He started off with Quick Reader, and he also has an app called Mega Reader. You can check him out by going to quickreader.net, and he has links to all of his apps there. He has multiple languages and all kinds of stuff. Quick Reader teaches you how to speed read. It's a pretty cool app. I've used it. And then Mega Reader is more of just like an ebook reader. You can get access to a bunch of free public domain content. The thing I like about what Patrick did, he's had great success and he's, you know, been living off his apps for a few years now. And he's just starting to do some talks in his local area up in Portland, kind of his experience and things he's learned. But he made this great viral video. He hired some guys to do it. And it didn't actually generate that many sales for him, but we'll link it up in the show notes. It's pretty funny. It's just kind of like a humorous commercial of someone using his Quick Reader app. So wanted to congratulate Patrick on, you know, all his success.
Speaking of MicroConf, I realize that we haven't really thanked any of the this year's sponsors for MicroConf on the podcast yet, or even mentioned anything about them. So this year we have Ruben Gomez from BidSketches being a sponsor this year again. We also have Redgate, FoxyCart, Balsamic, and Software Promotions. And then Microsoft and Constant Contact are both coming in with big sponsorships this year. So just want to definitely say a big round of thanks to those guys for helping out. And we also have WePay, Cumbia, and Dashable, who are signed on as sponsors. So we'll be talking a little bit more about those guys in the coming podcast. We'll definitely link to those guys in the show notes. But if you're interested in any of the services that they have to offer, definitely check them out. We've been trying to concentrate on sponsors who would be able to kind of contribute to the community itself and have things that would help people with their businesses and launch them.
Our sponsors are such a critical part of MicroConf. Both of the first 2 years, we wouldn't have been able to pull it off without the sponsor money. You know, we rely a lot on our sponsors, and so we definitely want to give a big thanks to those guys.
Today, we're going to be talking about some B2B startup marketing strategies. And this podcast idea came from Adam Klinkett, who lives in Brisbane, Australia. He's also a Micropreneur Academy member who runs a website called Booking Times, which is a SaaS-based practice management software for health, dental, and medical providers. And he wanted to know some more ways that he could get in front of small business customers. So his product is, I'll say, just about launched. He's more or less doing beta testing, early access. But he's really looking for ways that he can start scaling up some of his marketing efforts and getting in front of more small business customers that are specifically in search of the type of problems that he's having.
It's a big question, right? We actually get this question, or at least I get it via email fairly regularly, of, hey, I'm about to launch. How do I market my app? And it's like, wow, that is a huge, huge question. Literally could write books on it, right? There have been literally books written on this. But specifically, what's nice about Adam's question is he had a few things that he threw out that he was asking for more information about. And knowing specifically what his app is actually, you know, kind of corrals the conversation so that we can spend 20, 25 minutes on it here and actually get some realistic information out. I want to start by saying we could come up with 100 different approaches for marketing, right? We could throw out AdWords and SEO and infographics and all this stuff. But you can't just go in all those directions at once. You have to find approaches that work, since most of the approaches you try are not going to work. And I think that's important to realize, is that most of the stuff you try is not going to work, but the few anomalies that you pull out and that you're able to capitalize on and scale up, that's what's going to be the flywheel that grows your business. And so the two steps in doing this to find the approaches that work are, number one, to put together a big list of ideas. And most people don't do this. They skip this step. I've taken the time with both of my last couple apps to put together a Google Doc, which is a big bulleted list in different categories and such. In Hittail, it's 14 pages. And for Drip, it's 10 pages. And this is just single-spaced bulleted lists of all these thoughts, these ideas. They come both from me as well as podcasts I'm listening to and audiobooks. And over time, I've gathered this huge corpus of essentially marketing ideas. And you obviously have to pare this down and you prioritize them, use your best judgment. I mean, you basically take your best guess at which one you think is going to have the most impact, start at the top, and then start implementing them. And that's why you have to track everything, right? Because you're kind of throwing darts. You have educated guesses, but you're basically taking a guess at what's going to work. And so step two is to track everything, see what's converting, see what's repeatable, and shut it down if it's not.
And I think those are all great points to follow. And you said people aren't putting together these lists of ideas. So when they get to the point where they're working through a set of early access customers and they're really identifying and zeroing in on the issues that people are having, they turn around and they say, okay, well, what's next? And they don't necessarily have a good idea of where to go. And this list that you put together can definitely help point you in the right direction, because then you can use it to prioritize that list and say, okay, I want to try this next. And if that doesn't work, maybe do some tweaks with it, readjust, and then continue working through that list.
So we've broken down these marketing strategies into four different categories.
The first one is inbound marketing. And there's a few different things that fall into this category. There's content marketing, there's blogs, you can use infographics, head term SEO on marketing pages, forums, all these different things that you can try. And for content marketing, you can either use a blog or an email list. Specifically, what you do depends a lot on what your primary goals are. So if you're trying to drive traffic to your site, you're going to do one thing. If you're trying to educate the users, you're going to do something slightly different. So you really need to try and determine what your primary focus is before you start going and implementing some of these things. So, for example, if you wanted to drive traffic to your site, an email campaign is probably not the best way to do it. You're probably going to want to lean more towards using blogs or infographics. And if you don't know where your business is at, if you're not tracking any of the metrics associated with this, it's going to make it hard for you to measure how well you're doing with any of these things.
Yeah, with inbound marketing, there's some really great resources. HubSpot provides a ton of fairly detailed reports. You can also find a lot of people doing inbound marketing at inbound.org, which is a joint venture between SEO Moz and HubSpot. The thing to keep in mind when you're doing inbound marketing is this is a lot of what most startups focus on, or even just most online products. This is a lot of, aside from paid acquisition, this is kind of the main thing that people doing internet marketing focus on. And it's easy to get caught up in the flavor of the week. That can work in certain niches. Or, hey, there's a Facebook page marketing strategy that does this and that. The thing to keep in mind is that the fundamentals that have worked for years are going to continue to work. And that is things like blogs, infographics, and choosing head terms of SEO and going after them with your main pages. I think in terms of blogs, it's kind of overhyped or just over-talked about. A lot of people, when they start their, you know, start their marketing site, they launch a blog and they don't even really know what to put on there. And you got to think this through, because you can't just sit there and write about your app or write about how to use it or write about anything, because no one cares about that. What you have to do is educate them. You have to educate them on a topic that somehow relates to your app. So if you look at the blog of Kissmetrics, which is at blog.kissmetrics.com, they do a fantastic job of actually creating, that's content marketing at its best, right? It's actually creating articles that people want to read and that they are drawn to through social media, and they're shared through Twitter and Facebook. Buffer did a similar job. If you go to bufferapp.com, I think it's /blog. One of the founders, you know, just blogged for about a year. He also did a lot of guest posts as well. But that is one way to use a blog as a true social media content marketing thing. And you could also add infographics, guides, tutorials, pocket guides, etc. to that. And it just draws in traffic, but it draws in waves of traffic. It doesn't tend to be a super long flywheel. The other way to think about it is to think about a blog as a long tail SEO tool. And that's where a tool like Hittail comes in, is that you pick certain keywords and you just have someone cranking out articles. And so as an example, with the Hittail blog, I have a writer who is writing, I think she writes 4 articles a month right now. I'm about to kick her up to 8 articles a month. And she logs into Hittail and looks at the terms that are suggested for our site, and then she turns each of those into an article. And so these are not big blockbuster top 10 ways to do this, you know, awesome articles like you'll see on Kissmetrics. They're smaller articles, and they're building a snowball of traffic over time. It's long tail SEO, and it's traffic that doesn't have a lot of competition, and it's very consistent, but it's not huge bursts of traffic. So there's really two pretty different ways to approach blogging and that type of inbound marketing.
Something else we haven't really talked about is some of the mainstream media. So press releases, newspaper articles, and getting listed on news websites like CNN or, you know, various blogs out there. And one of the issues with getting involved with those or getting links back from those places is that you get a lot of traffic. It comes in huge waves. You'll get a lot of traffic very quickly, but then it'll taper off just as quickly, because as a news site, things are important on the day that they're released and they're heavily promoted. Maybe they get to the front page of that website and then they fall off and they end up in obscurity where nobody ever goes to look at them. And you will still get some of the backlinks from that stuff, but it won't be nearly as much as you would from, as Rob mentioned, some of the other types of blogging strategies that you would look at.
Yeah, the traffic also doesn't convert that well. Mainstream media may send you a lot of traffic, but you're going to just get a tiny, tiny amount of those people who are actually interested in your app. And when I had that quote in the New York Times, I got more trials that week from a mention on a WordPress blog. It was a popular WordPress blog, but obviously the readership of that WordPress blog is a lot less than the New York Times, but it's just so much more targeted. So given that it's really, really hard to get into mainstream media and to get mentioned in a large publication like that, for now, unless you really know how to do it, I would say forget it, because it's so much easier to target these smaller niche blogs and podcasts. And the pitch is easy. If you approach a podcast, they're almost always looking for content. They're looking for people with interesting stories. And as long as you can come up with an interesting story, you just say, hey, let's chat. Here's the story. I'm not going to plug my app. I'm a developer. I would love to share my knowledge and educate and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, you just get a good pitch down. When I did kind of the podcast tour with Hittail about 15 months ago, I emailed 12 podcasts and I got 11 yeses. And I went on all of them. And that was an early stage inbound marketing approach that I used. In terms of blogs, going out and pitching guest posts to blogs, you have to do it right, but it can absolutely work well. This was a tactic used by Buffer. I've actually used this as well with a couple of my apps. It is very time consuming. And in fact, all of these inbound marketing strategies are fairly time consuming, but they're free, right? Unless you're hiring the writing out, and at a certain point you will need to, because you just won't have enough time to do it. But these are the strategies that can drive a lot of traffic and that don't require a huge amount of money to get started on. So these are definitely the early stage kind of foundational things that if you're a bootstrap startup and you don't have a ton of money to invest, that I would recommend that you start looking at.
I think the last one that we also haven't talked about is forums. And forums are one of those things that have really fallen by the wayside in terms of, I'll say, mainstream developers that I talk to and associate with. Most people don't think to go look on forums, but it's just mind-boggling the number of people who still go to forums and still use forums. There's all these niche websites where they will have their own forums for different things. And LinkedIn, I think, is probably becoming one of the places where a lot of people are, at least in the professional community, are gravitating towards, because they have all these different forums and communities where you can subscribe to different groups. And you, as a member of that group, you can post in their quote-unquote private forums. And then they send out emails to everybody who's in the group saying, these are some of the new topics that have come up, which draws people back in to the website. And obviously that benefits LinkedIn. But if you're talking about things that are relevant to that community, then you can use that to help drive traffic to your website. And it's not just limited to LinkedIn. You can definitely use this strategy on other websites where they're discussing particular problems that are associated with that niche.
One of the best ways, at least long-term, when you're first getting started and you're just trying to get every user to come to your site to check out your app, it's cool to just hang around some forums. It totally doesn't scale, but you hang around, you get known. You don't want to be the spammer guy who comes in with a commercial every time, right? You actually want to be someone involved in these forums. It doesn't scale long-term, but it's something that you can think about. Long-term, set up Google Alerts and look for some key phrases on the internet. Google will find these forum threads, and then you can pop in and at least check them out. And if they're asking something specific specifically about your product name. You can always step in and say, hey, I'm the owner, and here's the answer to your question. Here are my thoughts, whatever. I still do this with Hittail, by the way. It gets mentioned on forums, and I pop in and say, I'm the owner, and people have never had a problem with it because you've already been mentioned, so it's not like you're coming in to pitch your app. And then if they're talking about something else related to your app, so you know, with Hittail, it might be long-tail SEO or long-tail keywords or something, you have to use your judgment of whether or not you can pop in and just offer suggestions or thoughts, and then include your link in the signature, or you can just mention it, you know, by the way, I'm the owner of this tool, so take my name with a grain of salt. When I do this, I'm very careful not to come off as being like a sleazebag guy, because you see the people in the forums who do that, and it's irritating. But this is definitely a way to take the pulse of people, because these are actually people discussing your app or your topic. Aside from one-on-one conversations and emails, this is a really good way not only to, you know, to get people interested in your product, but also to figure out their pain points and to figure out the issues that they're having, perhaps with competitive tools.
So the next approach that we've came up with is outbound marketing. And with outbound, you're really talking about reaching out to people through the phone. You're using direct mail, email outreach to people. One of the things that I've found is that email is a proverbial goldmine, and there's a lot of different reasons for this. The first one is that it's almost free to send these emails. Obviously, if you're sending them through your own ISP because you're sending direct one-to-one communications, there's obviously no issues with that. But even when you start sending out, you know, hundreds or thousands of emails, it is very, very cost-effective to send these emails out to people. And using things like MailChimp or AWeber or Constant Contact, you can get in front of people who want to hear that information, especially if you've built up a mailing list, because these are people who signed up for that mailing list, and they have essentially said that they want to hear from you about this topic that you've put together for them. So for whatever reasons that you put in front of them to convince them to sign up for the email list, those are the reasons that you continue sending emails to this list and promoting whatever material it is that you want to send to them. So whether it's security information, or in the case of Adam, if you're sending information about how, as a small business, they can deal with specific problems that are in that industry. So if there's new legislation that's coming out, or if there are new tools that they might want to be aware of, these are all great things to share with them. And as long as you're sharing information as opposed to giving them a sales pitch every week, it's going to go over really well.
I think there's two ways to look at email outreach. The one that you've said is building up your own mailing list, right? People come to the website and then you build a list and you educate and offer insight and you help them out. And then over time, you just kind of become a trusted advisor and they might check out your app. The other way that I've seen done pretty well is I've actually had it done to me by several companies and I've become their customers, is the CEO or the founder or someone emails with a short email. It's out of the blue, right? Unsolicited. But it's a compelling pitch. And it's like, hey, here's what we do for companies like Hittail or, you know, like Drip. And these have been from a variety of different startups that are basically catering to other startups. And so I get the email. It's a plain text email. It's not some marketing thing. Because if it was a marketing email, I'd mark it as spam, right? Because you can't do unsolicited commercial bulk email to just a list. But these people are actually seeking people out. And this has worked well, as long as they've had a compelling value pitch. And it's not something that they're just, it's not a bulk email. It's not a copy and paste thing. They mentioned me by name. They mentioned something specific about my app. They mentioned how their app can help. And it's just maybe 2 to 3 sentences. Not all of them have gone over well for sure, but I at least investigate it when someone reaches out that way. And this is similar to the phone or direct email. Obviously, those are more time intensive or expensive approaches. All three of those can work. And I think if you're considering this approach, you really need to read the book Ultimate Sales Machine by Chet Holmes. And he talks about putting together your Dream 100, which is the top 100 clients that you would like to have. And then, you know, you can use these approaches in tandem, in a sequence. Contact the same Dream 100 multiple times. Work to get them to try out your app. In addition, you have to have a high enough lifetime value to make this worthwhile. You can't sell a product for $9 a month or a one-time $20 fee and do these approaches. They're just too time-consuming and too manual. So you really need to have a higher end, either a subscription app or a high upfront price point in order to justify the time and or expense of these outbound approaches.
And in terms of direct email outreach, like you had just mentioned, that you can kind of templatize that approach where you create an email template and then you have a couple of sentences where you're going to essentially insert personal details about that person. So you, maybe there's one or two sentences in there that says, hey, I heard you on such and such podcast, or I heard you on Mixergy and you were talking about this, and I just want to let you know this is what we do. And those are ways that you can cut down on the amount of time and effort that it takes to build those. But as Rob said, you really do have to make sure that you are being personable, you're relating to them directly, and you're letting them know that it isn't just them part of this massive mailing list that you bought from someplace.
So the third marketing category we have is paid acquisition. And paid acquisition is something that scales really well, but it's really hard to get right. And it's hard to find a channel that you can actually scale up. The typical approach to getting started with paid acquisition is to try out a number of different ad networks, number of different headlines. Hopefully you already have an idea of your customer demographics or where they would be or what they'd be searching on. And the interesting thing to think about is that most ad networks are not going to work for B2B because they're catering towards consumers. So ad networks like AdBright and Chatika and Advertise.com, there's a bunch of them that I specifically tried out about a year ago. They're junk traffic if you're trying to sell B2B stuff. So the ad networks that I know of that probably have the most volume are Google AdWords and now Bing Ads, since they have the inventory of all the Yahoo searches. They actually have a reasonable amount of volume. LinkedIn ads, Facebook ads, and buy-sell ads. I'm sure there are others out there, but those are the ones that can provide enough people that if they actually do work, that it can scale up. You can also buy clicks through Stumble Upon, but those do tend to be people that are kind of wasting time rather than wanting to buy stuff. So I'd use that as more of a viral market approach rather than a paid acquisition strategy for a B2B app. And the thing to think about when you're doing these paid ads is you really have to go in with a small budget, do a trial, and see if the cost to acquire a customer is less than your lifetime value. And it should be a lot less. Typical rule is it should be a third or less of your lifetime value. And if you can make that work and scale this up, you have found an amazing flywheel. I really have. It's a lot harder than it sounds. People think when they're starting these apps that they can just buy traffic and that it's going to convert, and it's actually quite hard to do that. And even if you find a source that will convert, it tends to be really hard to scale it up because as you try to expand your ad spend, the quality of your traffic goes down. And so then you start having to pay higher and higher amounts to acquire customers. That's really the high-level overview. There's obviously a lot of detail to this topic that certainly a more in-depth course is warranted.
And the fourth marketing strategy is to leverage partnerships and what's referred to as OPN, which is other people's networks.
OPN is from Dan Martell. I wanted to give him credit. MicroConf 2012, his talk, he talked about OPN and how you can, you know, build your startup through using other people's networks.
So with partnerships, what you're really looking for is either joint ventures or integration marketing or affiliate programs. Any of these things can be mechanisms to help scale your business up. And obviously, you need to know what your sales pitch is going to be and what resonates with your customers, because that's what other people are going to want to know. They're going to want to know what sort of market you have, what sort of audience, what do they respond to, how is there an overlap between your users and their users. Those are all important things. And one of the things you have to be really careful of is that you are not going and approaching people whose networks are, I'll say, orders of magnitude larger than yours. So if you have a network of users that is 100 or 200 people, you don't want to approach somebody who's got a network of 100,000 people and ask them to do a joint venture, because it's probably not going to work very well, especially if you're saying, hey, you promote something to your users, I'll promote something to my users. That's just not going to go over well, because one of their questions is going to be, how many users do you have? And when they find out that there's this giant disparity between them, it's going to reflect very poorly on you. So what you really want to do is you want to find out if there are ways that you can sell your product through them and essentially give them a cut. And it's a slightly different way of doing a joint venture, but you have to know what those numbers look like before you start going and approaching people, because you want to know what's going to be in it for them.
Yeah, I've had some joint venture emails that have gone really well, and I've had others that have just been train wrecks. But luckily, you do enough of these and it kind of evens out. The key is to really know your audience and know that you're going to have overlap with the potential partner's audience. That's the bottom line. The nice part is once you get an email or two and you've sent them out and they work, then approaching new joint venture partners and saying, hey, email your audience and I'll email mine. We won't do any affiliate stuff. It's just kind of a one for one. Our lists are similar size. That actually doesn't take that much time. And I was surprised. I was doing this last year for Hittail, and I emailed 9 potential partners. They're like SEO rank trackers, just affiliated tools, right? Of people who would use that would use these tools would also probably use Hittail. And I got 9 responses within about 3 days of people who were like, yeah, absolutely, let's do that. And I was overwhelmed. And I've only done 2 of those because I wanted to space them out. And I was surprised at that response. And I do think this is an underutilized approach. And then the second part of partnerships you touched on was integration marketing that I've also mentioned in the past. And that's things like Hittail, we integrated with Basecamp. We have a HubSpot integration we'll be launching in the next week or so. We have a WordPress plugin. Not only are you trying to get the partner to tweet out, potentially blog about you and get you some traffic, but you also want to be on their integrations page because those pages do get a nice chunk of traffic, both from search engines and from the people who are actually using the app. I've seen integration marketing work quite well, and we're going to continue to invest in that with both Hittail and Drip.
So those are the 4 B2B startup marketing strategies that we came up with. The first one is inbound marketing. Second one is outbound. Third is paid acquisition. And then 4th is partnerships. And as sort of a bonus, we also thought about how to improve word of mouth. And one of the things that I'm not really convinced of is that you can effectively do this as a small business at a scalable level to make it worth it. Because how many times do you have to hear about a product before you've decided to look into it or seriously look into it? If you look at some of the research behind how many times someone hears something before they start investigating it, what you'll find is it's like 6 to 12 times. And the unfortunate part of that is that it means that you need to get in front of them 6 to 12 times before they even start considering you as an option or decide, I've seen that before. Maybe I should look into it. And as a small business, you can't do that effectively when you are so small. Companies like Microsoft and Dropbox can do that because they will get in front of people dozens and dozens of times. And it's very easy for them to do it because they've got billions and billions of dollars to spend on marketing. You don't as a small business. So you're going to run into problems trying to leverage word of mouth to get in front of more people.
Yeah, I'd agree with what you said. I also think that, building a great product is probably the best way. Solving a problem really well is a good way to get people to talk about you. But as you said, when you only have 50 or 100 customers, which when you're getting started, that's what you have, people aren't going to be talking about you. You don't have the scale. I think another aspect of this that can be helpful in getting people to talk about you is to try to be everywhere. That means be on the blogs and be running ads and pipe in on forums and be on podcasts and be in the conferences. As long as you're within a small enough niche and you're not trying to target the entire world, you can pretty quickly cover the landscape of a lot of places where people frequent. If you look at the web design niche, if you guest posted on 5 web design blogs, very specific ones, within a month, and were also on a couple web design podcasts, you would cover a huge amount of territory, and people would start to feel like, wow, this guy really is everywhere. So that's another way to get people kind of thinking you're at top of mind, and they feel like you're more legitimate. I mean, you are. You're actually out there, especially if the stuff you're sharing is interesting and educational. It can really get people more excited or more interested and willing to talk about your app. The idea that you're going to just have your existing customers go out and promote your app, it can get you a few extra customers. And you can use a product like Ambassador. If you go to getambassador.com, that's actually what I use on a couple of my apps. That's actually a great way to do it. They give you some forms and some other ways for your customers to share your product with other people and actually to get a cut of the price if that's what you want, or just out of the goodness of their heart. I mean, however you want to set it up is fine. But so there are definitely tools out there to do it. I haven't seen this done to scale to really starting, getting, aside from viral loop applications, which are typically B2C apps, I'd have to see an example of one before I'd believe that word of mouth can really be used and be a repeatable process to grow a B2B app.
That's right. And I think that in terms of focusing on improving word of mouth for your application, I think that there's a lot of other much lower hanging fruit that is probably warranted to go after than to concentrate on how do I improve word of mouth for my application when I'm just starting out.
If you have a question or comment, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.